Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer in Tel Aviv. This week normally represents both Israel's most solemn and most celebratory time of year. First comes Yom HaZikaron, Memorial Day, mourning and commemorating the fallen soldiers and terror victims throughout the country's history. Then, the very next day, comes the transition to Yom HaAtzma'ut, Independence Day. But nothing in Israel has been normal since the October 7th terror attacks and the beginning of the Gaza war with Hamas. Last year's Yom HaZikaron memorialized more than 24,000 soldiers and over 4,000 terror victims. This year, over 1,500 names are being added to those lists, a huge exponential leap. Yom HaZikaron begins in the evening with a sad, solemn national memorial ceremony marked by a siren that's repeated the next morning when the country comes to a halt and stands in silence. The next evening is the uniquely Israeli moment when another massive national ceremony switches the mood from mourning to celebration, paying tribute to the country's accomplishments with festivities, singing, dancing, and celebrations. This year, as I've said, is different. There is so much loss, so much more to mourn on Yom HaZikaron. With the country in crisis during the war, nobody is in the mood for a party. And this is radically affecting the way the country is commemorating. Official government celebrations have been scaled down significantly, both to set a more appropriate tone and because of fears of political disruption, and both ceremonies are squarely focused on October 7th. My two guests on the podcast today represent two other ceremonies, one old and one new, both set up to offer an alternative to the official government commemorations for very different reasons. We'll hear soon from Carly Rosenthal, a representative of Combatants for Peace, which annually organizes a joint Israeli-Palestinian ceremony on the eve of Memorial Day, designed to be an opportunity for Israelis and Palestinians to grieve together and stand united, demanding an end to war and bloodshed. But my first guest is Abby On, part of a group of members of families of Israelis being held hostage by Hamas in Gaza and their supporters. They have organized an alternative ceremony for the evening between Memorial Day and Independence Day. Those interviews coming up. Abby On is a member of the Calderon family, which was torn apart by the October 7th attack. Two family members, Carmela and Noya Dan, were murdered on kibbutz near Oz, and three members of the family, Ofer Calderon and his two children, were taken hostage. The children, 12-year-old Erez and 16-year-old Sar, were released in the November hostage deal. The father, however, Ofer, continues to be held captive. Abby, Ofer's cousin, has been tirelessly advocating for the family across international media since October 7th, and she's involved in organizing a first-time alternative independent ceremony this year. Abby, welcome to the podcast, and thanks so much for agreeing to be here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Traditionally, Israel holds this big national ceremony on the evening dividing Yom HaZikaron, the day remembering fallen soldiers and victims of terror attacks, and then they immediately kick off the celebrations for Yom HaAtzma'ut, Independence Day. At this ceremony, honorees for their contributions to the state light torches and give short speeches. You are part of a group of families of hostages still held in Gaza who have decided to stage an alternative ceremony, presumably staying away from the official government one. Can you tell us a little bit what will happen at this ceremony and why the decision was made to mount it in the first place?
Sure. I think it comes as no surprise that we are living in an altered reality and that this year is different, right? We sat at Pesach Seders 2 weeks ago, and we spoke about freedom, and we spoke about them not only thinking about the exodus from Egypt, but thinking about our family members who are being held hostage right now in Gaza. And that same idea hits when we think about how we commemorate Independence Day in Israel. And so there are a group, mainly women, who are family members of hostages, who said they want to do something different. They feel the need, we feel the need to commemorate the moment from memorial to independence that lets us say that we're living in a different reality. And the event itself will have a number of women who are on stage who have gone through unbelievable trauma and tragedy in the last 7 months. And rather than commemorating or talking about heroism, which we absolutely believe has happened, it's more of the effort to try to heal and rebuild. And so to do that, the women will be speaking about what has happened to them from October 7th on. And they will, in essence, be putting out a flame, putting out the flame of their trauma and their grief and oftentimes anger and sadness, and lighting a new flame to say that we're building a new reality together, that we need to strengthen one another, and that this is an opportunity to acknowledge that we're somewhere else this year.
The women are hostage family members, former hostages themselves. Who are they generally going to be?
Their family members, their mifunim, people that have been displaced, their hostage people that have been, their hostages that have been returned. It's a number of people. So from my family, my cousin Galit will speak. She herself was in kibbutz Kisufim on October 7th. And when she came out of her mamad after 23 hours, she found that five of her family members were unaccounted for, including her mother and her daughter, and two of her niece and nephew and their father. And as of today, her mother and her daughter were found murdered. Her niece and nephew and their father were taken hostage. Erez and Salha were returned at the end of November, and Ofer is still in Gaza.
It should be noted that the main government ceremony this year is being pre-recorded without a live audience instead of the usual live extravaganza with singers and dancers and everything. Do you think the country should even celebrate Independence Day under the shadow of the hostages continuing to be held in Gaza and the war continuing? I mean, do you think that anything festive and celebratory is out of place and should be suspended?
I think on one level, you know, the group of organizers of this alternative ceremony don't want to speak for the country, right? I think they're really trying to speak from their own experience. And so no one's here to say that you shouldn't go to a barbecue with your friends and family. And no one's here to say that we shouldn't show gratitude both to the army who is fighting on our behalf and both to the people that came before and building and setting up the state. It's mainly to say that, like, we didn't have the, you know, crazy parades at Purim, that there's something different about this moment and that it's incumbent upon us to build a different way to acknowledge and commemorate that and to try to rebuild from the ground up the people that have been fighting alongside the country, the civilians, since October 7th.
Is there an implied criticism of the government by doing something on your own instead of presumably participating in whatever it is that the government is planning to do?
I don't know. I don't think that this is necessarily critical, but felt organic in the sense of they will, in this ceremony, thank the military. They will acknowledge heroism. They just don't feel that it should be in the same kind of celebratory fashion and that this felt more authentic in the way that they are building it.
On a more personal note, how will your family be facing Remembrance Day and Yom Ha'atzmaut this year? You, as you've mentioned and described when talking about Galit, your family is experiencing the full throttle experience of this war. You've lost members to the October 7th attacks. You've had members of your family held hostage and then released. You're continuing to advocate for the member of your family still being held hostage. Is there any semblance generally of normal life in your family and specifically on this holiday, or is everything different and you're just pretty much full-time devoted to the advocacy work?
I think everything is different, right? I think since October 7th, our world, personally as a family, but as a nation, has been on fire. And I think that it's impossible to say that we're going to do this the same way. On the other hand, I'm grateful to Israel and also to kind of Jewish tradition that gives us the ability to demarcate and commemorate moments. It's important to spend a day thinking about the people that we've lost, both before October 7th and since October 7th. And the existence of the state of Israel is critical. And so there's something there. It just looks and feels very different for us this year. And I think we need to treat it as such.
I would imagine that on Yom HaZikaron, you're going to be paying tribute to the two members of the family who were murdered?
Two that were murdered, yes.
Can you talk about them a little?
Yeah, of course. You know, you clearly hear that I am not a native Israeli. So my cousin Carmela, her father came from the U.S. and built a kibbutz in the north, Ein HaShofet. And when she was, I think, 20, she moved to near Oz and helped build that kibbutz. And she kind of became the matriarch of our family in Israel. She had three children and 12 grandchildren and was deeply devoted to the kibbutz and to the land and peace and fighting for peace. She was a baker and a gardener and loved beauty, and she loved her family, and she was the person that her grandchildren went to talk about everything. And when this was happening, when we were reading the text messages, and there were people saying, "We're not sure that we'll come out of this," she said, "Talit moral, raise your spirits. We're going to survive this." So even in the worst moment, she maintained optimism. And she was with her granddaughter, Noya. They had been together for, you know, the holiday meal the night before. And Galit left Noya with Carmela. They had a very special relationship. Noya was autistic, and they really just kind of got each other. And it is every mother and every human's worst nightmare to walk out of a bomb shelter and learn 10 days later that they were not hostages, but they had been murdered. So I think this day for this year and for every year forward will hit differently for us as a family, and for those that have come back from our family, for Erez and Sahar. They're physically here, but their father is still being held with no word of if he's okay. Their home was burned and their family members were murdered. And so we as a family, but we as a country, as a nation, we can't move forward until these people come back. And I think it's necessary that we do something that helps the people, the first line of people like Galit, to speak her trauma and do even something small to rebuild. She has another daughter. She has another child that she has to raise in this country. And she needs to know that there is a strong movement of civilians who are willing to acknowledge that things are not as they were.
How are the two children, Sahar and Erez, who spent 52 days in captivity, doing now?
They're not okay, right? Like they're physically in Israel, which is better than others, right? But they are physically trying to get back to whole, but emotionally and mentally, they can't even begin that journey until their father comes home. They are from near Oz, a kibbutz in which one out of four was taken hostage or murdered. Their life was shattered on October 7th. And we need the 37 remaining hostages from near Oz, and we need all of the hostages home in order for them individually and for all of us to begin figuring out what's next.
It must be so difficult for your family members to deal with the constantly changing reports in the news regarding a hostage deal. From day to day, it changes. One day they say that a deal will be imminent. The next, they say the chances are very slim of it happening. How do you handle that?
For me personally, I can't speak because we have a very big family here. But for me personally, I try to remain optimistic. I think, as Rachel Goldberg says, hope is not an option. And I kind of go with the idea that I'll believe it when I see it, right? So you know that this is going to ebb and flow, that there's going to be reports, and that things clearly have not happened since November. And that what we can do is fight and talk and share the story and make sure that people do not forget that there are innocent civilians being held hostage in Gaza right now. And that if we want any of these tensions to decrease, the number one thing that can happen is for Hamas to release them.
The criticism of how the government is treating the hostage issue, the level of anger and frustration seems to be growing among the families, especially as a military operation in Rafah appears imminent. We've got regular demonstrations daily, almost, by families blocking highways in Tel Aviv, mounting demonstrations in Beersheba in Jerusalem. Do you share this harsh criticism of the government and how they're prioritizing the hostages?
Look, I am not a diplomat or a government official. I have no real understanding of the complexity of what they're up against, and I can criticize all day long, but truthfully, I think it's just more helpful for us to make as much noise as possible about this, because there are two aims in this war, right? There's the eradication of Hamas, and that doesn't exactly align with bringing hostages home. And so while people focus on both, I just want to make sure that the latter one is the hostages. I don't know how to do anything else because there's so much complexity involved. And so as an American and an Israeli, my role or where I've been able to find my place is just to tell the story as much as possible and for people not to forget that there was a ceasefire on the 6th and that Hamas broke it and they took our family. And this is not within the rules of war, that this is a humanitarian crisis that the world should be responding to. It's not just Israel, it's also the United States, it's the 18 leaders that signed this letter a week or a week and a half ago, demanding the release of these hostages. And I think that we just need to keep pushing that be the main issue.
Most of our listeners to this podcast are overseas, many in the United States, but also around the world. And many of their hearts are breaking both for the hostages, for families like yours, and also for the Palestinians in Gaza, the civilians who are suffering because of the current conflict. Do you have any kind of message for those people who are, you know, watching and listening and caring from abroad but aren't quite sure what to do?
Absolutely. Look, I share it. I think, you know, from day one, we mourn every loss of life, whether it is the people that were killed at Nova or in the kibbutzim, whether it's our soldiers or whether it is the people of Gaza. No matter what the situation is, a loss of life is the worst outcome. And I think that what we need to continue doing is not necessarily trying to polarize or trying to fight, but remind people that both sets deserve to live, right? My children in Israel and the children in Gaza, they deserve to live. And if we identify that as a shared, as a common ground, if we can figure out how to agree on something as what's seemingly basic as that, then maybe we have a way to talk about what's forward. But look, 7 months in, I don't know anyone that wanted any of this, wanted war, wanted this massive loss of life, wanted to see the polarization around the world. And from our perspective, we believe that once these hostages come home, the decrease in tensions will be significant and immediate.
Abby, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We all are wishing and hoping for good news regarding the hostages that remain in Gaza. And we're looking ahead to this the ceremony. It should be fascinating and moving.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, an interview with Carly Rosenthal from Combatants for Peace. Carly Rosenthal is communications manager for Combatants for Peace, a grassroots movement of Israelis and Palestinians working together to end the occupation and bring peace, equality, and freedom. Carly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Many of our listeners are familiar with the annual joint Israeli-Palestinian Memorial Day ceremony, which has been happening for 19 years now, but many are not. So can you tell me about the ceremony and your organization, which is closely identified with this event?
Sure. So the joint Israeli-Palestinian Memorial Day ceremony is jointly organized by Combatants for Peace and the Parents Circle Families Forum. As a member of Combatants for Peace, we're a binational organization of Israelis and Palestinians that support peace and nonviolence and an end to the occupation. This ceremony is really a unique opportunity for Israelis and Palestinians to mourn together, to grieve for their loved ones that they've lost throughout the conflict, and to offer an alternative vision for the future, one of hope and living in a different reality to what we are in at the moment.
So it's both a live event, right, and a virtual event. What usually happens at it? What kind of experience is it?
So last year we had around 15,000 people physically in a park in Tel Aviv for the joint ceremony. We also had around 200,000 people join the broadcast online, both from Israel and Palestine and all over the world, which is incredible. And we had people, more and more people each year growing. This year, due to the current situation, we decided to have the event online and instead organize many different screening events, both locally and abroad.
So 3 days later, after the ceremony, there's what's called a joint Nakba ceremony. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So the joint Nakba remembrance ceremony is organized by Combatants for Peace. And we started the ceremony about 5 years ago as a kind of complement to the joint Memorial Day ceremony. And it's an opportunity for both Palestinians and Israelis to meet and commemorate the people who were killed and have suffered the events of 1948. For Palestinians, this is called the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic. And around 700,000 Palestinians, you know, were expelled from their homes, became refugees. And so this ceremony is telling those personal stories and connecting around that.
And over the past 19 years since the first Memorial Day ceremony, you've had a lot of logistical issues, both in terms of getting Palestinians and Israelis in the same space. And that was before the added challenges of, right, the pandemic and other conflicts, and also a lot of political controversy over the ceremony. What has it been like? What kind of obstacles have you faced, and how has the ceremony managed to overcome them?
So, yeah, for our listeners abroad, maybe I'll say a bit of the context of this ceremony. So it is organized every year on Israeli Memorial Day, which is a, you know, a very solemn day of mourning the victims of terror and those who have fallen while serving the army. And what we're trying to do is offer this alternative where both not only Israelis and Palestinians have the opportunity to share their stories and acknowledge the humanity of the other, but also offer this alternative vision. So over the years, we always have disruptions to the ceremony. You know, it's a very controversial ceremony within Israeli society, within Palestinian society. And what we're trying to do is offer this space of community and uniting around our shared humanity. And, you know, there are government officials and people who will come to disrupt and protest the ceremony. And despite all of this, I think it's really important to us to continue to do the ceremony, especially this year. Last year, we had people outside of Parque Ayacón, where we had the ceremony, who were shouting over the speakers. You know, you could even hear it on the live stream. So this is something that's really important to us, to take care of our supporters and the people who are bereaved and sharing their personal stories with the audience, and for the attendees to feel safe and like they can be in this space without that disruption. So that was a main motivator for us organizing it online this year, as well as many venues in Israel were not open to hosting us due to these security risks, as well as it being a controversial ceremony.
So is this the first year, except for pandemic maybe, that you have not had an actual physical ceremony and it's been only virtual?
We are having it only virtually this year, but we are also organizing many physical screening events. So there will be events on Erev Yom HaZikaron, the eve of Israeli Memorial Day, in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, in Beersheba, in Haifa, and also all around the world. And you can find out more information about joining those on our website and on our social media.
In terms of the content of the ceremony, how is your organization approaching organizing it? What to put in it? Who should speak? how it looks this year? Is it going to be very different from previous ceremonies?
So this year we decided the theme of the ceremony is going to be children during war. And that's because we, as Israelis and Palestinians of Combatants for Peace, we want to see a better future for our children here. And, you know, too many children, too many people have been killed and are suffering. And this ceremony is an opportunity to honor them and to remember them and to also say that we don't want this for them. We want a better future for them. We will have speakers who are both bereaved Israelis and Palestinians, many of whom have been affected since October 7th. So it will be a really emotional and inspiring ceremony this year.
There's, on one hand, a vastly increased amount of loss and suffering on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli Jewish side. On the other hand, it seems to an extent the scars of October 7th or the open wound of October 7th is maybe leading to a little bit of decreased sympathy and solidarity on both sides. On the Israeli-Jewish side, there's a lot of talk these days of sobering up, of people on the left being less committed to pursuing peace and dialogue and reconciliation because they feel so devastated by what happened on October 7th. I'm curious if it's harder for groups like yours to put people together this year on both sides of the conflict.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been a challenge. Honestly, we're still going through it and people are suffering on a personal level and a collective level. But as an organization, as Combatants for Peace, I think we're really lucky to have this shared sense of trust and partnership that we, you know, we organize and work together throughout the year, not just around these ceremonies, but around many different activities that promote peace and nonviolence and an end to the occupation. So we are organizing this together through that spirit and through this hard time. And we see the value of supporting each other and the importance that the ceremony brings to us and also to many people here and around the world.
And you see people as being more interested in participating, less interested in participating, the same as other years? Like, what are the differences?
I think there's definitely many people who, you know, might not join this year, but I think for the most part, we've seen a lot of support. We're also, you know, have been organizing a crowdfunding campaign and have been, you know, nearly reached our goal and have been really successful in raising, you know, almost 300,000 shekels of people who want to support the ceremony and have had, you know, thousands of people register to watch it online and attend events. So it is really, it is really inspiring to see that there is still this will and support as well.
I was going to ask you about contributions from abroad because the ceremony has this long list of sponsors of different organizations and synagogues and people abroad who are supporting it. Did you find a similar level of support from previous years or any changes because of the war on October 7th?
I think we still had a lot of support, and I think a lot of people want to see us as this alternative and see, you know, the hope, like through the situation, there is a lot of loss and pain and division, both here and abroad in the conversation as well around the conflict. And everyone's eyes are kind of on what's happening here. And so what we offer is this vision of, you know, what does the day after the war look like when Israelis and Palestinians actually can live together, can support each other, can see each other's shared humanity. So in that way, the ceremony exemplifies that. And, you know, our supporters abroad have stood behind us in that vision.
To wrap up personally, Carly, I'm curious what it's like to be in peace work these days during the war in October 7th. I actually wrote an article recently about two Palestinian-Israeli activists who have this podcast, Unapologetic, where they talk, among other things, about the challenges of being in the peace business at this time. And especially for you, what it's like to work with Palestinian partners while this is happening in Gaza, both sides of the border. And I'm sure you had your own experiences October 7th and beyond. So can you talk about what it's been like for you?
Sure. I think that For me, you know, I'm originally from Melbourne, from Australia. I grew up, you know, in the Jewish community there and felt very connected to Israel and learned Hebrew growing up. And I came to Israel in order to be involved in peace work and to do this activism with Israelis and Palestinians. And, you know, I've been living here for the past 6 years and been involved in, you know, to various capacities in different organizations and initiatives. And what is so special to me about Combatants for Peace is this binational work that we really have staff co-working both in Tel Aviv and in Beit Jala in the West Bank, Israelis and Palestinians who are committed to seeing this vision of a non-violent, peaceful solution to the conflict. And since October 7th, you know, things are horrible and tense and painful and personal because it's not just a conflict that we intellectualize and talk about. It's like my friend Ahmed that has lost, you know, more than 60 members of his family in Gaza, who's a longtime activist in Combatants for Peace, you know, or it's members of Combatants for Peace who served in high-ranking, you know, military positions in the army and then refused to serve and joined this organization in hopes of ending the occupation, have gone on this transformational journey, as well as from the Palestinian side, you know, were former fighters in this conflict, have spent many years in Israeli jails and have given up that path and seen, you know, that the only way forward is through this joint nonviolent struggle.
Do you speak a lot with your friends and family back in Australia and how they view the conflict, and how do you come to them talking about it and talking about your work here?
I think I'm lucky that personally I have many friends and family that support me and support the work that I do. If anything, it's been more challenging here, and I see that pain, you know, both from Israelis and from Palestinians criticizing my work from different angles. And it kind of often feels a bit hopeless and like, you know, each day is something new. But I try to focus on the people doing good work who are believing in peace and believing in, you know, we can end this. We can choose to have a different future here.
How do people who are listening and want to view the ceremony, how do they find it?
So you can join a physical screening event in your city, or you can watch online in your home with your family and friends or on your own through the links that are in our Facebook and Instagram and YouTube pages of Combatants for Peace.
Carly Rosenthal from Combatants for Peace, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. Thanks to my guests, Abby Ahn and Carly Rosenthal, to producer Amir Factor and editor Nara Malkin. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. And if you have, give us a 5-star rating on your podcast platform of choice. And don't forget to subscribe and keep up with the latest news from Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world on Haaretz.com. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, Shalom from Tel Aviv.